For NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Robin Hilton. Let's just say, of all the people currently on the planet who have picked up the electric guitar to rock, Jimmy Page is my favorite. And obviously, I'm not alone thinking that. Jimmy Page has been busy over the last few years. He's looking back at the music he and his Led Zeppelin buddies have made. Those records are being remastered under his guidance, and extra music is being unearthed and released as companion discs. The latest one is Physical Graffiti. The original double album came out 40 years ago this week. Jimmy Page was in London, Robin and I here in D.C. We wanted to talk to him about that release, plus his recent book of photographs, a remarkable book he's put together that tells the story of his life in pictures. And we figured this is also a good chance for him to play DJ and talk about the songs that changed his life. So Robin and I waited and heard nothing but silence from London.
I thought I'd have like a moment of suspense for you. Yeah, here I am. I'm here. No, but me.
Seriously, who is this?
thanks for doing this.
Really, you're welcome.
So after a bit of playfulness, Jimmy Page got right down to telling the story of Physical Graffiti and how they came to make that sixth record.
The essence of Physical Graffiti is the fact that we go back to this house, this residential house in the countryside called Headley Grange, where we'd recorded the fourth album. And during the process of the recording in various rooms and the great hall, etc., where the drum kit goes and you get the evidence of this wonderful reverberating chasm of when the levee breaks, The prospect of going back to Headley Grange to revisit and to be starting a new album was really, really exciting. Because we'd been doing a lot of touring. We now had five albums out already. And it was always a fascinating prospect going into record, to be honest with you, because it was always going to be a sort of summing up of where we were and where, at any given point of time, if we were recording. And where we were was trying to push ourselves collectively, you know. And in the process of that, because of the quality of these four musicians individually, let alone collectively, we were pushing the boundaries of music and aware of that, you know. And but on this album, or we should say the double album, Physical Graffiti, there's so many characters. The whole thing is just full of character sort of statements of music and numbers, and some are really, really groundbreaking, and you get things which are maybe very sensitive and caressing. You get other things which are really hard and coming at you, you know.
One of the things and that you pushed on this record, and you hear it in the extra record that you've got on this, is that keyboard part that opens
In the Light, Everybody Makes It Through is the working title, because that's part of the lyric, you know.
Let's hear a little bit of this. For people.
Sunshine brings laughter. Rain clouds brings down. I know. Forever after, I need the light keeping me ground.
Had you even remembered that part of the making of the song? Because we'll play in a moment what happened to that song for those who don't know, but tell me.
Okay, yeah, no, I remembered this approach to it. This is really right in the early stages of what is going to be In the Light. As it continues, you start to hear the framework of the riffs and the et cetera, et cetera. But this is like the initial run-through working of it. You know, there's different lyrics to it. It's a really good example of Led Zeppelin at work, really, because this is the embryonic state of what is going to become In the Light. And when you hear this and you realise that there's this incredible keyboard part that's going to go on at the beginning that John Paul Jones plays, and then Robert comes in with these block vocals, which is sort of reminiscent of music of Bulgaria. And I've got to say that, you know, it's it's been wonderful being able to do these companion discs, because this is the sort of thing where people will just go, wow, that's really, really cool. And it just gets them thinking about the whole aspect of what Led Zeppelin was and its music and how hard it worked on the music too.
Let's hear just a tiny bit more, and then I want to play the version we're more familiar with, just a bit of that. You described one thing that I'd like to make a little clearer, which is that you're all in this big room together playing. You're not in some studio behind little barriers and with, you know, your heads poked up, right? I mean, describe the scene, the room that you're in.
It's in a residential house, and it's the equivalent of the sitting room, the lounge, you know, the main formal room where you'd have your Christmases. You know what I mean? In a large house. It's basically that, the main reception room. And there was that was the main area where we kicked off recording when we were there on the fourth album. And there was a fire in there, and you know, you could put logs on the fire, and it was all really, really nice. But the benefit of this place was it was a residential house, and having a mobile recording studio and a truck outside on the two occasions of like the fourth album and this, which was going to be the sixth album, was superb. So you could actually really get to work on this stuff without having to necessarily go into a studio, you know, and comply by other people's hours. With this, you could just wake up in the morning, have your breakfast, get into the music, you know, and that was it.
And make something
have
that sounds...
evening meal. I can't remember really now what we used to have for lunch. I just remember sort of the whole work ethic of this, and it was just so productive. It was on the fourth album, and lo and behold, here it was again. But the whole revisiting of Hedley Grange meant that I sort of knew what could be done there as far as the huge drum sound in the hall and the coziness of this sort of room where we could just run through things. The drums aren't in the hall there, obviously. It's all in the same room for eye contact. And it's a really interesting, it's an interesting piece. But as I say, it's so good to be able to have these alternate things within the companion disc, because it just gives so much more information on the overall catalogue. If you start from like Led Zeppelin 1 all the way through to Coda, it just really is going to give so much more information to the recording and studio world of Led Zeppelin and what that was, because, you know, there's that, turn the coin, the other side of that is the touring one. So it was really good to be able to have an opportunity and to forge a project so that all of this stuff could be heard.
Let's hear what you came up with in, for those who don't know, the rest of In the Light. We'll play just a minute of the top here. What is that drone, by the way?
That's acoustic guitars that are bowed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you hear like the machine sort of coming on with it. I mean, it's, yeah.
I assumed it was some sort of Indian, like, I don't know, a didgeridoo or a hurdy-gurdy. I didn't know what...
You know, but that's great. You know, the whole idea of it is to sort of bring forward a sound or sounds that you don't know what it is. And it's really cool because it really sets it up for what he's doing now. This amazing... John Paul Jones is playing that keyboard part.
Let's listen.
Do we have time to just listen to the whole record?
Well, the whole thing about it is you can already see what we were doing, we were really exploring music. We weren't doing singles. We didn't have a ball and chain on the group. You know, right. We were able to just really push in such a way like this, you know. And that's what it was about. You know, it was important that we did that.
Yeah, you've said in the past that this record, Physical Graffiti, was a high point for the band. When you were going through this again, did it hold up for you as sort of the group's most creative and expressive
No,
album?
I wouldn't say it was the most creative. I think every single album was really creative and experimental in its own way. But what comes out on this is it's a double album, and it's like the mother of all double albums. So, so isn't it, really? Let's be honest. So it's fair enough to say. And plus, it gave the opportunity to give three tracks that were recorded at the time of the first visit to Headley Grange. I think it's so important, this visit to Headley Grange, this residential aspect of it, and this sort of, this working ethic, which was just like eating, sleeping, and working, you know, it was just superb. I mean, I really enjoyed all of that.
The three songs that you're talking about.
The three songs that didn't make the fourth album. And you can imagine, because the four songs are all really interesting, but you couldn't have replaced any of the other tracks that you know to be on the fourth album with it. No, but one's Boogie with Stew, which is real fun. That's just a real fun thing with Ian Stewart playing piano, and he was just absolutely an astonishing master of Boogie Woogie Piano. He plays on the Early Stones records too, because he was like a member of the Rolling Stones. And he came along with the when the Rolling Stones mobile truck was there, he came along to see how things are going and all of that. And Stu and I were friends from ages beforehand anyway, so it was just fun to get him playing. Another song that was not left on, that wasn't on the fourth album, but clearly needed to be heard, was Down by the Seaside, and also Night Flight. So you got the three tracks there that didn't make the fourth album, but it was clear that they were good, strong character pieces. And within a double album, yeah, sure, this is the way to do it. And plus, put Houses of the Holy, the track called Houses of the Holy, on it. I mean, that was always intended to put when the album was named Houses of the Holy, the fifth album, the track that was literally called Houses of the Holy, and I thought it was such a good idea to put it in on the next album, whatever the next album was going to be, because in those days you could do something like that, and people would say, why do they do that? I don't understand. And simple answer is because they can. But now you wouldn't be able to sort of do this sort of thing, because there'd be such an internet forum of everything that you were doing, and if you sneezed, there'd be sort of a major sort of, wouldn't there? You know, tidal wave of tweets. So, but you know, in those days, you could really keep your cards close to your chest. It was cool.
I was having a wonderful time going through what is an absolute labor of love, the book, Jimmy Page by Jimmy Page.
Oh, great.
I have so many thoughts looking through this book, but the very beginning of the book, which isn't a photo at all, I want to start with, is a little couple of paragraphs where you talk about being a kid, moving around, moving into a house, and then there's this guitar.
Yeah.
And I wonder what you feel about the nature of fate.
Ah, well, you know, that's a long and it's a long subject, isn't it?
I'm going to take my shoes off and kick back.
Yeah, I know. Let's put another log on the fire.
Please.
It has to be sort of considered and not just dismissed, this whole aspect of fate, really, of the fact of these four musicians coming together later. It really is. You've got people from two different geographical locations in England. Well, you know, John Paul Jones and I were from the south, and John Bonham and Robert Plant were from the Midlands. And it has to be sort of fate, you know. There has to be an element of it.
Bob and I were going through the book and listening to the album yesterday, and one of the things we said was, how did these four guys find each other? It's too perfect. It was just such a perfect union.
And it was fast. It was really fast because, you know, I'd been in the Yardbirds prior to this, and the Yardbirds were still doing shows in July of 1968, and Led Zeppelin come. Well, and they've already sort of thrown in cards. They don't want to continue, but the last dates that we're doing are in July, and I've got this band rehearsed with all of the material, and we're doing dates in sort of September in Scandinavia. So it's the same year as the Yardbirds Fold. Mm. We've already recorded our album by October. It's, you know, it's a sort of blueprint that all these people in the music business dream of. But, you know, the thing was, it was real, very real.
Talking about the book, I love the very first picture you have in here of your very young boy singing in the church choir. And the choir director or choir master's name is Mr. Coffin.
Absolutely.
Which is just wonderful, priceless. But I look at this picture of you singing, and I think, you know, did church music, the music that you were singing and playing in the church, have an early influence on you?
I think, well, I mean, it quite clearly did, the whole aspect of harmonies, and because it was a full choir. That photograph is sort of staged. It wasn't actually there and then during the church service or anything. But no, it was a sort of fair choir. There was a fair amount of people in it, sort of maybe 18, 20 people. And, all the sort of harmonies and all that was really, I really enjoyed singing in the choir as a kid. I mean, you sang at school, but you didn't have this whole ritual of getting into the sort of the clothes, you know, for the whole, you know, the sort of hassock, etc. You know what I mean? It was, I don't know, maybe that did have a whole effect on me as far as getting into the stage gear and playing. Who knows? It's possible, though.
The stage gear. You had...
Well, I thought the harmonies for sure.
Yeah. No, the harmonic outfits. Structure.
And I thought the outfits.
Absolutely.
I thought there was a shot. I think you're in a nudie cone suit. The Ukrainian fashion designer who made clothing for. I'm not sure if that is one or not in the book. Kind of a white suit with flowery pants.
Yeah. It's got like sort of. It's got a dragon on it, and it's got like sort of poppies.
Right.
Yeah. White one is.
Graham Parsons would wear crazy suits like that, and Porter Wagner. Yeah. Was that one of his designs? I just a quick.
No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Okay, but.
No. I was very careful about the designs on these things, and I also had a black suit which was sort of like a really, really heavy embroidery, like sort of a kimono. Have you ever seen like a proper kimono? They're really, really thick, the gold thread embroideries on them and that, and the silk embroideries. It was very much in the character of that sort of thing with the dragon.
Did you work on the designs with a designer? Is that?
I certainly did. I certainly did give them a real directive of it, but nevertheless, they worked on these things. I actually had, for the black one, I had the jacket first. And then the trousers were commissioned, but it eventually became a suit. And then the white one, I could afford to have it all done in one go by then.
Are they all in a closet somewhere?
I've got them very, very safely under lock and key.
You know, I hear that.
Do you know what? I'll tell you something that really is quite bizarre. Sure. Is that the dragon, it's called the dragon suit. People call it the dragon suit. That obviously was touring through a number of years. And yet, when you look at it, it looks like it was made yesterday. It's really odd.
Wow.
Really, really odd. There's no wear to it at all. It's really, really odd.
Nothing like quality.
Really.
You know, when I listen to this and think about all the work that went into the record, all the records really, is, you know, the band certainly has a lot of talent, but one thing that keeps coming up here is that a lot of work. It was a lot of work, a lot of thought, a lot of careful planning. Like, everything was just really carefully thought through, and a lot of effort went into it.
Yeah, no, that's true. You sort of summed it up, really.
Well, I just think it's an incredible work ethic. You know, so many people think, like, well, I'd love to...
rock and roll
Yeah,
band,
I want to be in a rock and roll band. I want to do that. Why isn't it happening for me? And, you know, one thing they wait for inspiration, but part of it's just a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yes, true. Yeah.
Were there songs in your growing up that changed you, that you heard, that just you went
yeah. Well, I'm pleased you've said it, because it gives me an opportunity to talk about Lonnie Donegan, you know, because you were saying about how this guitar sort of made an intervention to the family or the family home, etc. Right. And it quite clearly did. none of my relatives played guitar or anything remotely. Oh no, I did have an uncle who played a bit of piano, but I mean, he never showed me how to play piano, and I can't now either. But as far as the guitar, there wasn't any relatives who played guitar. But this guitar was there, and then there was this sort of explosion of music that happened for the youth in the 50s, and quite clearly it was rock and roll. But also what we had over in England was this guy, Lonnie Donegan.
And he
spawned the whole of the skiffle movement and caught people's imagination. And he was superb. He was absolutely superb. But there he was playing like an acoustic guitar and doing these performances sort of every Saturday. There'd be a show on the television where usually he was on every other week, and it was just something to behold at the time, just his whole passion and the way that he delivered his material. Now, the thing is that he'd been in a jazz band prior to that, Chris Barber's jazz band, and Chris Barber was very much somebody who... He played trombone, Chris Barber, but he was very much into the blues. In fact, he was behind getting Muddy Waters to visit England in the 50s.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely astonishing stuff, isn't it? And so when Lonnie Donegan, who was playing a banjo in his sort of traditional jazz band, when Lonnie Donegan wanted to sort of do these songs, he was fine with it, Chris Barber, you know, and bringing through the sort of blues, American country blues and all of that. So Lonnie Donegan is playing the song that I'm going to sort of give as an illustration of this is Rock Island Line, which at the time, obviously, we thought it was a Lonnie Donegan song, but it sort of goes back more to the sort of roots of Lead Belly, and he really understood all that stuff, Lonnie Donegan. But this is the way that he sort of, should we say, jazzed it up or skiffled it up. But it was to the point where you'll find so many of the guitarists from the 60s will all say Lonnie Donegan was the influence. So here you go, have a listen.
I'll tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. I may be right, I may be wrong. You know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Hallelujah, I'm safe from sin. The good Lord's coming for to see me again. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is the road to ride. Yeah, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you won't, you ride it, got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
You sort of hinted at this, but this guy's responsible for selling an awful lot of guitars, right?
Yeah. Certainly turning a lot of people on.
The Beatles, for sure.
Because by the time you get to the end of this, he's really spitting it out, Rock Island Line. It's fantastic stuff.
Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. Rock Island Line, you're a road to ride. Yeah, Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. If you won't, ride, got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
And you were how old when you first heard this?
Well, whenever it came out, I was born in 44, so you can add it in. So maybe 12, say. Just around the time of being that choir boy, I'd say.
This guitar that was in the house...
It was a campfire guitar, you know, the sort of a round hole. Yeah, literally that, like a campfire. But it did have all the strings on, which was pretty useful. Because I wouldn't have known. I mean, I honestly wouldn't have known where to get guitar strings from. And then somebody showed me how to tune it up. Somebody at school who played all those sort of Lonnie Donegan songs, to be honest. You know, it really is, it really washed everybody, all of this. So he showed me how to tune it up, and then I started strumming away, like, not quite like Lonnie Donegan, but having a go.
It's important for people to remember that your next-door neighbor didn't have a guitar. You know, that having a guitar was not a common thing like it is now.
No, there were few and far between the guitarists in those days.
But you took right to it. Did it just feel like you're an old friend right away? Was it a struggle? You learned and mostly self-taught because, you know, there weren't...
Well, I sort of learned very slowly in the early days, just sort of strumming chords and all the rest of it. But it was a little while before I got something which was like a proper professional guitar, if you like. And then I came on in leaps and bounds at that point once I got that. There's no doubt about it.
So, sure. Other songs that that changed you thought?
Yeah, okay. So we're listening to all this sort of skiffle stuff, and it was really good because it's a point of access for playing. And I say we, I mean all the guitarists of that who sort of started that way right across the whole of the country. Then you hear something on the radio like "How High the Moon," and it's like, oh my goodness gracious, what is going on? What is that? And what it is, it's Les Paul who invents the whole system of multi-track recording and the electric guitar, and he's doing these recordings at his home with his wife singing Mary Ford. And I've got to say that when you listen to his guitar orchestration, it's just absolutely phenomenal. I don't know where he sort of came up with it from, because it's not like big band brass voicings at all. It's just something that's totally unique and really, really iconic. You can tell Les Paul, and you know, I've had the great privilege to meet the man on a number of occasions, and he was just brilliant.
A wonderful photograph in the book about Les Paul.
Yes.
And I always wonder about the collaboration that happens between someone like him, an engineer, though he was a player, of course, as well. But, I mean, he made this instrument. He invented this instrument.
Yeah.
Didn't the idea of a guitar like this didn't exist before. And a player. Like, what is that relationship? Like, how did his guitar, which you love, Les Paul's, how did that change what you did?
What it is, it's the fact that, you know, I said he invented the multi-track recording. He doesn't have a multi-track recorder at this point, but he knows exactly, I mean, he was a scientist, and he knows precisely what he's going to do in these arrangements by multi-tracking, and you hear all this sort of voicing. He was his own engineer, as far as I could see at that point. It was just, he was doing things at home. He'd have Mary Ford singing in the bathroom and in the hallway to get sort of the ambience, you know, of various sort of rooms and situations. It's just incredible what he does. That he paves the way and he inspires. In America, you had the Les Paul and Mary Ford show. We never got that in England, but it must have been so inspirational to, you know, guitarists like, say, for instance, Cliff Gallup, who was somebody that we followed because he was in the Blue Caps with Gene Vincent. Clearly, you know, he paid so much attention to Les Paul in such a great way, you know.
We'll march right on with another song.
Let's get to something which is done in the 60s. We sort of know about, you know, Phil Spector's Wall of Sound and all of that, but in New York, there was, I believe it's Shadow Morton, who does the Shangri-Las. And Walking in the Sand is just phenomenal because it's got so much atmosphere on it. And the lead singer on it is just phenomenal, the Shangri-Las. But everything to do with this, the arrangement and everything, the sort of the drama of it is just fantastic. So I hope you enjoy that too.
Thank you.
Remember, walking in the sand. Remember, walking hand in hand. Remember, the night was so exciting. Remember, the smile was so inviting. Remember, then you touched my cheek. Remember, with his fingertips.
One thing that is wonderful about a piece of music is if in 3 seconds you can identify the song. We had this, John Congleton, who's a producer, talked about this. The notion that you can take and know in 3 seconds you have a defining sound, it is yours. And I think that's what your band did for sure.
Yep.
You know, immediately you knew it was you. And that's just the hardest thing to do. I don't know where it comes from.
Well, that's one of the things you do, isn't it? It's like Les Paul, you know, it's character playing, and you'd always be able to recognise Les Paul. And all the guitarists that you like, all the good guitarists, you can recognise them straight away. And that's quite something, isn't it, from six strings. And
that's right.
But it's got a lot to do with the tactile aspect of it and what's firing it with the spirit.
Do you remember at a point in your guitar playing where you knew this is you? I mean, where you felt your own sound congealed in some way.
I never really wanted to stop making it evolve, actually. So
yeah, but you thought about yourself as like, I'm not playing like other people. I'm not playing just the blues. I'm doing this, and no one else could do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because I wanted to have my own approach to what I did. I didn't want to sort of to do like a carbon copy of, say, B.B. King or whatever, but I really loved the blues. The blues had so much effect on me that I just wanted to do my own contribution in my own way, if you like.
Is there a song?
So that's how you come up. That's how you come up with things like Since I've Been Loving You.
Of all these songs, and maybe there's one more.
Rosalind is something which, you know, when I was asked to come up with some songs, I'd like to play Rosalind because it's by the Pretty Things, and the Pretty Things, this is in their really early raw state, and it's at the time when the Rolling Stones have first started as well. But the Pretty Things were really, really wild, and you can hear it. You can hear the energy on this thing. It's amazing, and it's captured on the recording. It's not all filtered down. You know, it's not watered down. They've just, whoever's been in charge of this has done such a great job, because they've really captured the whole spirit of what went on. Do you know what I mean? Because it could so easily have, you know, and when there's a group that are a bit wild, you go, well, turn down your amplifier, and, you know, can you play that so it's not quite so abrasive on the ear? No, this is what's so good about Rosalind, and it's her first single, and the Pretty Things. And the Pretty Things went on to grow musically. They were the first ones to do like the equivalent of a rock opera. They were a band that really, Phil May and the musicians, Phil May was a singer, they kept, you know, pushing what they could do. And they were actually on the label Swan Song, which was where the first, well, the album that we were talking about here, The Physical Graffiti, that's the first Led Zeppelin record to be on this label, Swan Song. It was a group's label. But we were able to bring in the Pretty Things because the work that they did on Swan Song was superb. And anyway, but here they are in a really, really raw situation. And I hope you enjoy it. But he said that excitement, and capturing that sort of excitement, not trying to emulate Rosalind, but you've got the idea of it, you know, the thing with walking in the sand, the whole drama, the whole statement of what's going on. Being able to capture those sort of things on analog tape was what I really wanted to do. ¶¶
there's a wonderful picture of you and William Burroughs. It's not musical per se, and you talk about this wonderful machine, the Argonne Energy.
The Argonne Accumulator.
Is that, yeah. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Well, let's say William Burroughs, I was contacted and asked if I'd like to do an interview with William Burroughs interviewing me, and I went, absolutely, 100%, 1,000%. He'd actually been to see Led Zeppelin at the Madison Square Garden, because he was in New York on not just one occasion, but numerous occasions, he told me. And he was connecting the essence of trance music with like riffs that repeat over and over and over, with what he'd experienced when he was in Tangier in Morocco, and the Djuka musicians and et cetera, et cetera. And he wanted to do an interview connecting this whole aspect of things with literally what was like riff repetition and trance music of what we were doing. Now, he came, as I said, he did witness more than Led Zeppelin on more than one occasion, and I was really filled to bits with that. But just in the process of talking about various subjects, there was talk of there was a lot of talk at that time about pyramid energy, and we were discussing that, because it was said that if you had like a pyramid cone, you could, if you put a blunt razor blade in it, he didn't say this, I might add, but this was like sort of street talk, that razor blades would resharpen and things like that. So we're talking about the sort of energy generally, because we're talking about trance energy, and we're talking about this sort of energy. And then he says, do you know who Wilhelm Reich is? And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, I've got an Argonne accumulator downstairs. And I said, you have? And he showed it to me. I didn't go in it, but he went in it for, 10, 15 minutes every day.
It's a little room with a room. It's a chair. It's a cabinet.
It's what's in the walls of it. Yeah, and it looks like a little sauna cabinet. That's what it looked like. But it certainly wasn't a sauna cabinet. It was something that rather than sort of make you boil, it would just actually send the energy back to you that you're expounding. And this is what he believed, and he subscribed to it because he did it every day. And of course, I was fascinated by all of this stuff. It was the most magical time to spend with somebody that I held in such great esteem.
We only have a couple of minutes. I want to jump ahead to the end of your book. There's this fantastic photo of you playing with the band in a reunion show.
Yeah.
In 2007, and you all have the biggest smiles on your faces.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what it means to you to play these songs at this point in your life. You know, when you were writing the music, nobody could have imagined anyone over 40 or 50 playing these songs, right? But
no,
here they
true,
are,
yeah.
You know, so that's still such vital music. I'm wondering what it means to you, how it resonates with you when you're out on stage and playing these songs.
Well, it was so good to be able to play the numbers with John Paul Jones and Robert Plant, and especially Jason Bonham, because I'd actually toured with Jason Bonham on my own. I had my own project back in 88, and he did the touring with me over in the States, and that's a long way back. So we jumped from 1988 to 2007, and we'd done Led Zeppelin songs when I was with Jason then, and Jason was really youngish, but it was really good to be able to sort of concentrate on the music and just really enjoy ourselves with it, and that's exactly what we did. You know, Jason, who we'd known as John Bonham's son, it wasn't Jason the kid, it was Jason the man, Jason the group member, and it was so cool to actually take it on like that, as opposed to something which, and be very serious about it and put lots of work into it. It's this work ethic again, isn't it, coming up, but to be able to sort of be really, really sort of juiced up and well rehearsed and so well connected with each other that it was going to work on every level, and that was cool. The celebration day, the DVD that came out of it, you can see it. You probably have seen it, and it's pretty cool. You can see that we're really seriously on it. It's not just like guys going through the motions. It's just like it was in the days of Led Zeppelin. You're right on the edge of the precipice from beginning to end. And that's how you want to live it. That's how I want to live life, and I always have.
You've done great. This book Thank is you a very great much. Testament to you. I have a 30-second question, honest and truly 30 seconds.
Go on.
In Washington, D.C., there's this lore that Led Zeppelin played a venue called the Wheaton Youth Center. It's a recreation center that is listed in your book. When I went through it, there's actually a little documentary about the fact, did they play here? Did Led Zeppelin play in Wheaton, Maryland, in this little youth center in 1969? And the book lists it as a concert on the tour. And I wonder if you have any recollection of, like, the day Nixon was inaugurated here in Washington, D.C., you played at a town, you know, 10 miles in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., at a rec center. You have any memory of that?
When is it? In 69?
69, yeah. It's January 20th, 1969.
Well, look at that. You see, it's right in the beginning of the history of Led Zeppelin and touring over there. And it doesn't surprise me that we were playing something which might have seemed rather odd. You know, in retrospect, thinking of all those huge stadium shows and all of that. But, you know, we were starting and we'd play wherever they would take us, you know.
But no particular memory of that actually having done it, because the rumor is you did, or once people say you didn't, so we're trying to figure out if it's true.
Well, we wouldn't have got reviews for it in those days,
right.
You know, but definitely would have been called Led Zeppelin and we'd have been around, but it's pretty close because we start off in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and that's basically right at the beginning of January. So, you know, it would have been very, very early on. But I tell you what, it would have been quite life changing listening to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank
Cheers.
You.
You're all wonderful. I appreciate your time today.
Cheers. Thank you.
Jimmy Page talking with us from London. The remastered Physical Graffiti double album is out with its companion disc. His book of photographs is simply called Jimmy Page, and it's out. It's a treasure to look at. And thanks to Jimmy Page. I'm Bob Boylan along with Robin Hilton for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.